And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms and restrictions apply.
The Athletic.
Hello and welcome to the Athletic Football Tactics Podcast. You know what we do by now, I think. I'm Ali Maxwell. And this week, top-level football pauses for its March international break, and so do we. We're pausing from club football to put on our international football hats. Actually, let's call them international caps. With me this week, pod stalwarts Michael Cox and Mark Carey. I would say very much the Jordan Henderson and Harry Maguire controversial to my Gareth Southgate. How are we today, gents?
Who do you want, Mark? I would prefer Henderson on current form, I think, of the two.
I was going to say, could I have Henderson? Mainly for my Liverpool love, but I'll take Harry Maguire, that's fine.
I'm not going to differentiate. You're both leaders. You've both been dependable when I've needed you most. And I never overreact to a rare dip in form because I recognise the body of work that we've put together as a trio. And I feel a sense of reciprocated loyalty towards you that's really few and far between in the podcast game. So that's my response to any calls for a dropping of either of you. We are going to talk about England and we're going to talk about Gareth Southgate this week. We're 8 months on from defeat in the final of the Euros to Italy and 8 months before the 2022 World Cup. So it's time for a quick look at the current state of play in terms of tactics and personnel. Just to sort of recalibrate our brains, I think, from club football to international football. Michael Cox, on the spot, your favourite ever international tournament?
Oh, that's a good one. Probably would be European Championships rather than the World Cup. I liked 2000 a lot. I think that felt like a bit of a game changer in terms of going from broadly defensive football in the 90s to so much more technical football. There were so many playmakers who had a good tournament. Rui Costa and Totti and Bergkamp and Zidane. So 2000 was very good. I also like 2008, which is maybe slightly controversial because obviously England weren't there. But I think the 16-team Euros were great. It was just straight into real quality. And on a slightly different note, I think that's one positive thing about the women's Euros this year. 16-team tournament should be really good from the off. So, yeah, Euro 2000 I'll settle for.
I love, Mark, that Michael sort of weaved tactics and playing style into that answer. I wonder if you might do the same with your area of expertise, your favourite ever international tournament.
Yeah, that was very thorough. Mine was, you always just go instantly to the first major international tournament that you remember, I suppose. And mine was World Cup 2002. So the year that Trevor Sinclair had a great tournament, I suppose, should be what that was remembered from an England perspective. Yeah, it was just before school had started. England played the game against Brazil. Michael Owen scored. And then there was that famous Ronaldinho free kick, which broke our hearts. Mm. So that one would be the tournament for me.
Ronaldinho takes and David Seaman's cut off his line. And Brazil take the lead. Ronaldinho has scored. David Seaman is caught cold.
David Seaman's goals prevented rate, not the strongest in that knockout round. I'm going nostalgic as well. 1998 World Cup, the first World Cup final I remember watching. And I feel like I watched the whole tournament. Realistically, that has to be a lie because I was only 5 or 6 years old. But I had all the goals from World Cup 1998 video and therefore in the years that followed, ended up knowing all the goals in order from watching it thousands of times. Wonderful memories of getting home from school, video cassette already loaded in the VHS player, hit play. Oh, there's the glorious yellow of Brazil, the dark blue of Scotland. And there's lovely Bebeto with a wicked in-swinging corner for Cesar Sampaio to head home. And everything is right with the world for the next hour, at least. Sorry, I'm not sure what we're talking about anymore. I've drifted off there. Why aren't things as good as they used to be, eh? Why do they get worse as we get older? One thing that hasn't, in the last few years at least, England's results in major tournaments under Gareth Southgate. A World Cup semi-final, a Euros final, and a World Cup on the way. So just as he announces his squad for the March international break. We're going to whiz through the current squad, looking ahead at the all-important friendlies against Switzerland and Ivory Coast. And, of course, as soon as the squad gets announced, it starts to be renounced by many as well. So we'll touch on a couple of the talking points as well. Let's start in goal, where the three picked for the squad are Jordan Pickford, Nick Pope, and originally Aaron Ramsdale, who subsequently picked up an injury, has been replaced by Sam Johnston of West Bromwich Albion. Very rare to have a second tier footballer in the England squad, which, as you can imagine, is a quirk that I like to enjoy and talk about a lot. But if everyone's fit, Pickford, Pope, Ramsdale, Michael, this might be the easiest part of squad selection for Southgate. They're the only three English goalkeepers to have played more than 20 league games in the Premier League this year. So it's not an area of great depth, nor does it really need to be, I feel.
Yeah, I mean, I think Pickford is quite a solid number one at the moment. I know Ramsdale's had a really good season, probably a better season than Pickford, but I think Southgate tends to look at international performances. And while Pickford has had a couple of questionable seasons for Everton since the last World Cup, I think he's never really let England down. In fact, far from it. I mean, the biggest moment of his career, he saved that penalty from Jorginho, which could have been crucial had the next 5 minutes gone a different way. You know, we could be talking about Sir Jordan Pickford if Saka scores and the next one is safe. I think Ramsdale's a really good goalkeeper and it's good to have competition. But I think familiarity is important. And I think the defensive section of the side, almost despite the fact that England do switch between a back three and a back four, I think between the players who are at the back, there is a really good understanding. And I can't remember any games of the last two tournaments where I think England's defence or goalkeeper have let them down. I think tactically England have sometimes been outclassed. Midfield battle, I think, has been a bit of an issue both against Croatia and against Italy. But defensively and in goal, I think England will probably go for a pretty consistent lineup.
Michael showing the same loyalty to Jordan Pickford that Gareth Southgate has shown. 42 caps for him. Pope has 7. Ramsdale just 1 at the moment. Obviously, in the media and amongst fans, Pickford's place has been under question for about as long as I can remember him being in the team, to be honest. Mark, it feels like there's no chance of anyone usurping him at this point in time. Ramsdale's injury, very untimely, you have to say, on that front. Looking at the numbers this season in club football, at least, and we take Michael's point about, you know, loyalty to international performances, just talk me through these two, Pickford, Pope and Ramsdale, their underlying numbers, what we can measure at least in goalkeeping, because of course there are some blind spots with goalie stats as well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it was the first episode I came on for that we did that, the episode on goalkeeping. But yeah, I mean, you mentioned it before, Ali, with the goals prevented metric. So from a shot stopping perspective, we can look at it as essentially how many goals a goalkeeper would be expected to concede based on the quality of shots they face, and then that difference between how many goals they actually conceded. And that goals prevented metric is what we sort of look at. The more goals you prevent, essentially, the better shot stopper you are. And did a piece recently on Aaron Ramsdale of just how much he is leading, you know, amongst the highest in the Premier League on that front. But obviously, because he's injured, we can't really consider him too much here. But, you know, we think about Pope and Pickford, and obviously neither Everton or Burnley are exactly having the best seasons at the moment. And I always think from a goalkeeper perspective, when we think about these goals prevented, we need to account for the fact that they've faced a different number of shots as well. So even after adjusting for the number of shots they've faced, Pickford does just edge it from a shot-stopping perspective to Nick Pope, which is maybe surprising because that's sort of seen as Nick Pope's strength, isn't it? Shot-stopping more so than with his feet. I'll come on to Sam Johnston as well. It'd be interesting to get your thoughts on it as well, Ali. But obviously, Gareth Southgate places a lot of importance with what they both do with their feet. And Pickford is known to be just that bit better with his feet. But I looked at actually how much both players go long and how much they sort of launch the ball. And it's no surprise to see that Pope goes long 92% of the time in the passes that he makes. And Pickford's 77% of the time, which is still really high compared to obviously the top teams who like to play it really short. And Ramsdale will be a lot shorter. But yeah, with Sam Johnston as well, I mean, West Brom aren't having exactly the best season, especially compared to expectation, but it feels a lot like it's more them in attack. So the defence doesn't seem to be wholly, you know, that bad. I mean, Johnston's got 14 clean sheets in the Championship, which is the second highest of any player. West Brom actually have the joint fourth best defensive record in the championship. But I mean, talking about players with their feet, he had that blunder recently. Was it Huddersfield? Mm-hmm. That it just took far too long on the ball. And that's at championship level, at international level, you're going to get caught out for that, aren't you?
Yeah, this is probably the most anti-data analysis thing that I'll ever say on this podcast, but I genuinely believe in something of a curse on championship goalkeepers. I've been following the league pretty closely for about 6 years now, and it feels like every single goalkeeper in the championship is doomed to, at some point, and it might be on the first day of the season, or it might be on match day 46, throw in an absolute howler at some point. And so you get in this situation where 10 or 15 games goes by, and a goalie's got good numbers and shown some good shot-stopping ability, and you just wait for it to happen, and invariably it does. And I must admit, because we know goalkeeper errors stick in the mind, don't they, and they can really be hard to forget. Johnson's had too many this season for West Bromwich Albion. He'll point to the fact that under Val Ishmael, that the first manager they had this season before Steve Bruce took over, such a high line, really intense press, and Johnston was very, very isolated and committed the sort of errors that you might expect from a goalkeeper who has such a high line playing in front of him. You know, at his best, his shot stopping is the best in the division. I've no real doubt about that. I think he's the classiest shot stopper, the classiest goalkeeper in the way that he carries himself. But it's the second tier, and second tier attackers don't strike the ball with as much power and precision as the very, very elite players in the game. So I find it difficult to imagine really that Johnson off the back of this season would move up in Southgate's estimations. And clearly we saw that, you know, having been involved in previous squads as the season started, he wasn't included in this one until Ramsdale came in. Of course, Michael, Dean Henderson should at least be mentioned in this conversation, even if his lack of game time means that he's not part of it right now.
Yeah, I mean, he's an interesting case. About a year ago, it felt like David De Gea was on the way down, and people were thinking that Henderson should be the number one at Manchester United ahead of him. And if he was and was performing well, you think he would have had a good shout to be in the team, but he's not even in the squad. So yeah, he's very much out of contention at the moment. So, I mean, he's got five decent options there for England. I mean, it's been better than it has been at times, maybe 5-10 years ago. I remember there was a couple of times where England called up a reserve goalkeeper I hadn't actually heard of. Was that guy, was it?
I don't know, Frank Fielding?
Yeah, Fielding. I hadn't heard of him when he got in the England squad. I found that quite bizarre to have not heard of a player in the England squad. But there's some good options now.
Goalkeeping's just quite an unusual discipline, isn't it? Like, even if you look at the keepers who play, I just think it's so different to outfield positions, even at youth level as well. You look at the goalkeepers who fill up the England under-21s and England under-20s. These are two, you know, youth groups that I track quite closely. Very rare, Pickford being an exception, that they end up necessarily translating to the senior team as much as other positions. At least that's how I feel anecdotally. I mean, I remember Joe Lewis getting called up by England off the back of a League Two campaign with Peterborough, I think. Mm. He was called up in May 2008, an unused sub for games against USA and Trinidad and Tobago, and he had literally just played a season in League Two, which is pretty remarkable looking back. I'm sure I could suggest a few to Southgate. There's a couple of talented young keepers in Leagues One and Two, that's for sure. In the heart of defence, let's take a look. We've got six centre-backs: Harry Maguire, John Stone, Ben White, Tyrone Mings, Connor Cody and Mark Guehi of Crystal Palace. Michael, six CBs for two fixtures and the inclusion of Connor Cody. I feel like both of these are pretty good signs that Southgate will be sticking with a back three here.
I think he certainly wants the option. I'm not sure what system he'll play. He played a back four throughout the qualification campaign for the World Cup until qualification was sealed, and then he chose a back three for two pretty easy games against Albania and San Marino. But he certainly wants the option. I mean, at the Euros, five of the games he used a back four, two of the games he used a back three, including twice in the knockout stage. So certainly he wants to be able to play both. And yeah, the presence of particularly Cody and probably also Mings, I think, lends itself to potentially playing that system. And I think the other centre-backs in there are pretty comfortable playing in either system, as we have seen it at the Euros.
Talking about him wanting to have the ability to switch it up, the tactical flexibility that all managers, I guess, want to have. Some of them do more with it than others. Have you worked out any rhyme or reason to when Southgate will play three at the back, will play four at the back, why certain systems in certain situations?
To a certain extent, it's working backwards from the opposition. I must say, I still have reservations about his decision-making in the final two games of the Euros last year. I was really surprised he went with the back four against Denmark rather than matching them up with the back three. I think England was slightly lucky to get through that game. And then in the final, I kind of get why he went for a back three, because Italy kind of attacked with a back five and maybe he wanted to match that. But I can't help thinking he could have been a bit bolder and played Saka as the wing back on the right and really got him to attack Emerson, who I think was a weak link for Italy. I think England were quite meek in that final. I know it started very well with the two wing-backs combining for England's opener, but I think overall they lost the tactical battle. So there is some thought that's gone on with regard to working back from the opposition. But yeah, when it comes to the key moments, that's the one thing I would question Southgate on, his kind of tactical decision-making in the real big games, I think has been a bit of a weakness.
Of course, even if there was such a thing as the perfect squad selection, there would still be talking points because that's how it works. One of them this time round is around the inclusion of Harry Maguire in poor form for Manchester United recently, but a very public show of support here from Southgate, Michael.
I think he was always going to be in. I mean, him and John Stones have got a really good partnership at international level. He's been struggling at club level, no question about that, but you know, there's a widespread malaise at Manchester United, and I think it's slightly unfair that he's become the ultimate symbol of that. But yeah, he's done really well for England, particularly at the two tournaments. And also, I mean, this isn't the reason you will pick a centre-back, but he scored 7 goals in 41 games, which is pretty good considering England don't have many sources of goals. You know, aside from the real attacking players, Kane and Sterling, there aren't many players, well, there's no one else in the squad who's got more than 4 goals. So his ability to act as a target man, if you like, at corners, I think is quite important for England. Set pieces tend to be quite important in the latter stages of international tournaments.
Oh, basically, England's World Cup 2018 campaign was built on Harry Maguire's forehead heading home set pieces, wasn't it? At least that's how I remember it. Mark, I saw someone say on Twitter, and boy, do they say a lot of stuff on Twitter, that Tyrone Mings is only included in the England squad, and they went as far as to say only a Premier League centre-back because he is left-footed. Is that harsh, or is there some truth there?
Broadly speaking, that is harsh, but there may be some element of truth in it, simply because, I mean, Mings is having an okay season, and he's part of the established England setup now as well, so I don't think there was any reason to not pick him, per se, but I always think about Tom Warville's piece, which he did over a year ago now, and I'm actually seeing Tom later, which would be nice to see him, the piece that he did, which was basically looking at the role of a left footer in the build-up as much as anything of getting that. Well, he said the reasons are twofold, which is why it's useful for a left-footed centre-back: passing angles and trajectories. And I do think that there is, yes, some element of truth in it in that regard, that you can just open the left side up just that little bit more and maybe get just a couple of yards more to maybe the left back or the left wing back as well. And just on the note of Tyrone Mings and then Harry Maguire playing left centre back, it's something which I think Stu James did on site. I don't know whether people remember it, but it was how he controlled the ball with his outside of his right foot every time he collects it for Manchester United. And I've always seen it ever since, and I can't get it out of my head. It's really quite frustrating. So it's, if you can open your body up as the left-footed centre back and be able to kind of have that pass to the left back and sweep it further forward rather than almost playing it to their wrong side, I think there is an element of usefulness in that, especially international level.
And it's also worth pointing out, he started the first two games at the Euros when Maguire was injured alongside John Stones, and England kept 2 clean sheets in those two games. In fact, England kept 5 clean sheets in the first 5 games at the Euros. So really, the defensive side of things, I know there's a couple of players who've come to the fore. I think Ben White's a promising player, but you don't really want to be changing too much unless you absolutely have to at the back.
Well, we do have a squad first-timer at the back, Mark Guehi. He was the only squad debutant initially, of course, with 4 players now having pulled out through injury. We've got a few more that we'll get on to. Guehi didn't wait around at his first club, Chelsea, for a few crumbs of minutes here and there. He moved away to Crystal Palace, and he's in the England squad within a year. It's great justification for making what is considered a pretty brave move, I think, despite having seen a few players doing it now. At just 21 years old, how excited, Mark, should we be about Mark?
Yeah, very excited. Yeah, I think from a numbers perspective, again, it's something we've spoken about on this podcast of just how difficult it is to profile centre-backs with the numbers. But just looking at his sort of style as much as anything, using the numbers, he doesn't actually engage in a ton of defensive actions, but when he does engage, he's very good as a 1v1 defender, and that much is shown in his numbers, looking at some of his numbers on Smarter Scout. But he's also very comfortable on the ball, which, again, at international level is really important. He's really keen to carry the ball out of defence, which is a key strength of his. Really comfortable in terms of how many just touches he simply has on the ball. And it's something that I did fairly recently with our Crystal Palace writer, Matt Woosnam. We did a piece just looking at how comfortable he is on the ball and how comfortable he is to bring it out from the back as well, which, as much as anything, it was in contrast to the Crystal Palace centre-backs of the previous few years, of just how comfortable he is on the ball. But very exciting. And as you say, 21 years old, so much potential.
Fun thing about him is that there's a chance he could make his debut against the country of his birth, the Ivory Coast. There's been a few players like that. I remember Danny Welbeck came on for his first cap against Ghana. He was born in England but could have represented Ghana. I think Owen Hargreaves' first competitive game was the 5-1 away in Germany, who he could have represented.
Oh, nice.
So, yeah, fun bit of trivia there.
And on a more pertinent note, no time for frivolity here, Michael Cox. He played on the left side of a back three at Swansea in the Championship last season. So just in terms of being comfortable in that area of the pitch as a right footer specifically, and very much was tasked with starting their attacks, bringing the ball out of defence, as you say, with great comfort, punching passes forward into midfield. And I gather that he's been doing very similar things at Crystal Palace this season. So someone that I'm really, really excited about. Of course, he's not the only young defender, Michael, who's impressed in the Premier League. Guehi, Max Kilman has been mentioned of Wolverhampton Wanderers, but also Fikayo Tomori, also previously of Cobham and Chelsea, now doing really well for an AC Milan side who are top of Serie A. This is one that raised a lot of eyebrows. Tomori snubbed by Southgate.
Yeah, I mean, I'm surprised at that. I don't really understand how that works. He's been excellent for Milan. If we still have this thing where you're slightly ignored if you're playing abroad, I just can't imagine how that works. There must be some specific thing that Southgate doesn't really like about him. Kilman's an interesting one because he's a left-footed centre-back, but he plays on the right of the three for Wolves. So that's a very unique situation.
Yeah.
I can't really think of anyone I've ever seen who's done that before. So maybe there's question marks about how he would fit in. But England do have options. I think Eric Dier's playing well for Tottenham as well. Probably less in demand now because there's less need to have a player who can play midfield. A few years ago, that was a real area of weakness. I don't think it is so much anymore. So there are quite a lot of options in defence, I think, for Southgate.
And of course, Kyle Walker played as the outside centre-back on the right side at the Euros. So he's been left out of the squad altogether. Southgate saying, "I had a chat with Kyle. We felt this was an opportunity to have a look at the younger fullbacks. We know all there is to know about Kyle. He's a very important player and he'll be back with us in June." So when you're looking at the squad and particularly at the back, that's something to bear in mind. We're missing Walker, but he'll be there.
Yeah, and he's done the same before, hasn't he? He's left Walker out before when he came back and obviously was a fixture at the Euros. I actually really like Kyle Walker now. I think he's got a lot of stick for his lack of defensive ability at times, and people always
talk. Do you know what, mate? Do you know what? I'm going to say this. We did a podcast with Sammy Lee about Man City over a year ago now, and I've always liked Kyle Walker because no one has his speed in recovery. And I'm pretty sure I asked a question as to whether we need to be appreciating Kyle Walker a little bit more. And I didn't get as warm a response from either you or Sam as I was hoping for. And here we are. You've come crawling back in 18 months later. Good old Kyle Walker.
Well, that is very interesting. I'm pleased you approve, right, Ali? But the thing I like about him is he used to just be constantly overlapping. But now for Man City, he only does it once or twice a game, but he does it so suddenly and he times it so well that the opposition left wing or left wing back or whatever just isn't expecting it. And I think it's proving more effective to go once or twice in a game rather than six or seven times. So yeah, I think he's just a very useful option. And it's, I mean, Southgate is, you can ask questions about his lineups and the formations. I must say, when it comes to selection, I think he thinks about individuals a lot and what individuals need and whether it's right for them to be in the squad and whether it's not. And I mean, maybe we'll talk about Rashford later, but he's another player who just needs a break. And I think Southgate is quite good with stuff like that.
Well, you did slag him off for not selecting Tomori. That's the headline we'll be using, I'm afraid. So you can back him up all you want. I mean, Walker, it strikes me, has that thing, Mark, that's very hard to measure. You can see it when you look closely over a long period of time. And Virgil van Dijk very clearly has it and has been spoken about having it, of being so good defensively. Van Dijk in all areas, Walker probably most specifically because of his speed, that players just avoid the issue, that players just know now not to even bother taking him on. And that's an unbelievable strength. It feels like the equivalent of, what do they call it, attacking gravity, what Jack Grealish has, where just the very fact of him having the ball and driving at goal brings 2 to 3 players and opens up space elsewhere. I feel like the reverse of that is what Kyle Walker and Virgil van Dijk have.
Yeah, like a defensive force field, would it be something like that? Like, yeah. I was going to say, when you were saying about Kyle Walker before, he is a bit of a cheat code in that if there ever is anything where you do get, you know, the ball is played in behind, he's so fast that he can just recover unbelievably well. And that's probably maybe a note about those defensive numbers, where Virgil van Dijk is definitely key for this as well, where it looks like maybe his actions have slowed down. Maybe people querying about his, because of his injury, maybe he's not engaging in as much. But he and Kyle Walker, very much similar, as you say, you can't base it on that, because as you say, it's just that no one goes near them. So they have nothing to do but other than maybe organise and just make sure that when the time is needed, they have to sprint back. And similar, he gets quite annoyed when he has to sprint back, Kyle Walker, to be like, I shouldn't be made to do this, but just because I can, you shouldn't make me do this. But he's unbelievable.
That. Yeah, as luck would have it, both of the younger fullbacks that I believe Southgate was referring to as wanting to look at in the absence of Walker, Trent Alexander-Arnold and Reece James, have both subsequently pulled out of the squad through injury. So now he's got two more young fullbacks called up to replace them, Tyrick Mitchell and Kyle Walker-Peters. They join Luke Shaw, really, as the only fullbacks or wingbacks, if we're playing a three at the back system, in the squad, Michael. And of course, you can't forget Kieran Trippier as part of this conversation, who's always been one of Southgate's favourite generals. Just talk me through the situation at fullback / wingback at the moment.
Yeah, I think Trippier's still got a good chance to be involved. He's done very well since coming back and joining Newcastle. Has played a big role at the World Cup and the Euros as well for Southgate, like you say. Yeah, I think there's a lot of the players who've pulled out injured. People are always a little bit suspicious when players pull out of friendlies, of international friendlies. But they're actually players who I think really would have liked the chance to impress. Ramsdale in goal, and particularly Alexander-Arnold and Reece James. Alexander-Arnold in particular, I mean, obviously he's been left out of England squads in the past. I think just purely because when he has had the opportunity for England, he hasn't done that well. I don't think that's anything to do with his ability. Don't think that's in question. The games haven't gone right for him for whatever reason. So I think he's one who really does need just 2 or 3 good games for England, and he'll probably be in the starting 11. Without them, you think there's probably a good chance that both Walker-Peters and Mitchell will start. I think Walker-Peters is an interesting one because he's naturally right back. But when Livramento started the season very well, he was playing more on the left than on the right. I think at the moment he's still, this season, played more games on the left than on the right. He's a little bit uncomfortable there, but I think does a good job of it. And then maybe we can bring in Saka as well, who I think is perfectly comfortable at wing-back, particularly in games where England have a lot of the ball. And yeah, considering the lack of options there, I think he's got a good chance because Chilwell, obviously not available, and Shaw hasn't had a very good season. So that's a chance to experiment, I suppose.
Going back to the Trent Alexander-Arnold thing as well, you're completely right, Michael, in terms of wanting to prove himself, the wrong phrase, but to make sure that he can really embed himself within the setup. And we've got a piece out actually this morning, myself, Stu James and James Pierce. And he's Trent Alexander-Arnold's actually been an unused sub more times than he's played for England. So 17 times as an unused sub and 16 times he's actually played. So for someone, for all that we wax lyrical about him, you know, at Premier League level, and the context obviously being that the setup for Liverpool is set up to allow him to, you know, maximise his strengths. But I just find that quite interesting. And there's just some people historically as well with England where their club form just hasn't translated to the international stage. And he seems to be that version at the moment. Tyrick Mitchell will be interesting to see how well he does. I thought he played really well recently against Manchester City, having a good season so far. Surprised that Tarek Lamptey's maybe not been called up. I know that obviously they don't need as much options at right back already on the right side, but maybe just for this camp it could have been interesting to see. And I know he's only just recently come back from injury, but I thought James Justin, been He was doing really well, obviously, before his kind of big injury. Maybe it's a little bit too soon for him just coming back from injury, but it'd be interesting to see whether in future setups and future camps he could maybe be an option on the left, even though I know obviously he's a right-footed player, but he did really well on the left side for Leicester going back to before he was injured.
No secret, really, that the left side and the right side of defence is fairly imbalanced just in terms of talent and numbers, I guess, and experience at the top level as well. Of course, in the under-21s, there are four right-backs, to my eye anyway. Livramento, Lamptey, Ben Johnson and Jed Spence as well. It's pretty laughable, actually. It's a bit embarrassing how many good right-backs there are, and it's quite unhelpful for a number of those young ones who have players in Alexander-Arnold and James who are so young that you wonder if they'll ever really get much of a chance. An embarrassment of riches for Gareth Southgate. You probably can't say the same about the left-hand side of defence. So that's something to look out for. This is the Athletic Football Tactics podcast in part two. Rashford dropped, Sancho axed. And how many exciting attacking midfielders is too many exciting attacking midfielders? That's next.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Right, guys, in the centre of the park, we've got Jude Bellingham, we've got Jordan Henderson, Declan Rice, James Ward-Prowse and Conor Gallagher, absent Calvin Phillips through injury, but a key part of that team last summer. Michael, this feels to me like a pretty strong area of the pitch for Southgate without too many question marks.
Yeah, it would look a lot stronger, I think, if Phillips was there, who's done really well for England in a couple of different roles, particularly the Euros. Ward-Prowse, obviously a great set-piece taker. I'm not sure his open playability, if you like, is necessarily right for England. Conor Gallagher, very promising, but I'm not quite sure I see a role for him in this England system where the two midfielders probably have to sit deep because we've got so many outright attacking options in the final third. But certainly Henderson, Rice and Bellingham are very much international quality. And I think, to be honest, there's almost not that much to say about this role because it tends to be 4-2-3-1 or 3-4-3 for England. You've got two players broadly sitting there. Sometimes one has got a bit more responsibility to go forward. But there aren't too many tactical variations that Southgate uses. So I think it's just going to be a fairly solid partnership. Rice, and then if Phillips was fit, he'd be alongside him. Probably a choice now between Henderson and Bellingham. I'd quite like to see Bellingham get a go on the basis we know what Henderson can do. And I think it'd be good to develop that partnership, which even if it's not the first choice partnership at the World Cup, I think probably there's a good chance it will be after that. So, yeah, pretty solid options, I think.
And Bellingham, just 18 years old, Mark. How does he profile in terms of style of play after, what are we, almost two seasons in this Dortmund side? It always strikes me watching clips that he seems to do everything. Is that backed up by the numbers?
Yeah, well, especially from a tactical perspective. I mean, yeah, because he is so young and he can do everything, it's almost like he hasn't found his specialism. Not that he kind of needs to, because he is, you know, a jack of all trades, if you like. But yeah, so Dortmund play most commonly in a 4-2-3-1 or a 4-3-3. And Bellingham can play more of as a defensive midfielder, more of a central midfielder, or even as an attacking midfielder. And I think whatever position he's kind of placed in, he's still, you know, does the same thing and has the same attributes, obviously. So I think one of his main strengths is just how much he kind of glides past players. He's a really active dribbler. He averages 3.3 dribbles per 90, which is in the top 7% for midfielders in the Bundesliga. And I always think if you're a dribbler or you're somebody who maybe takes a little bit more risk because of your skill and your ability, you maybe sometimes lose the ball. And, you know, we've spoken about that with Alexander-Arnold and his amazing passing range. Sometimes they have to not come off to then find the the one that eventually does. But he keeps the ball, Bellingham, at such a high rate. So given the nature of his actions, he still has an 85% pass completion rate, which is still really impressive, really high compared to his peers. And because a lot of those areas are sort of high up in the pitch, is really impressive. So I know that it's bringing it right back down to pass completion, which I'm not the biggest fan of, but given the nature of his actions, really impressive. Still only 18, as you say, and he's played over 2,000 minutes this season for a Dortmund side who are granted not doing amazingly this season compared to previous, but still it's frightening just how many minutes he's playing for his age.
To be honest, the discourse around squad selection always seems to focus on those, realistically, on the fringes, those who might just drop out having been in, or those who might come in having not been in previously. But you get to talking through the squad, and this is an area where this is really highlighted. We're talking about a four in Bellingham, Henderson, Rice and Phillips, who look absolutely bulletproof here, and with only two spots up for grabs at any given time in this midfield. Unfortunately, it makes it hard to imagine where Conor Gallagher or James Ward-Prowse realistically get meaningful game time here with those four in front of them. So that's just the sorts of things that you kind of come to realise, in particular when you work through the squad and when you talk through it like we are today. You'll notice I've increase the amount of buckets and categories I'm putting players in here. The England squad announcement goes goalkeepers, defenders, midfielders, attackers. I've also added wingbacks and fullbacks to differentiate from centre backs. And then we've done central midfielders there. I've got the next bucket, which is attacking midfielders slash wide players, because I think that's quite helpful, particularly when we're talking through the formation. My only problem, Michael, is I don't know which bucket to put Mason Mount in, whether he should be in the central midfield bucket or the attacking midfield plus wide bucket. Southgate loves him. All managers seem to love Mason Mount. Where does he fit most naturally, do you think, into the 3-4-3, for example?
I don't think he's a central midfielder in this team. I mean, for Chelsea at times, certainly on one occasion, he played as pretty much a false nine away at Tottenham and in various kind of attacking roles. So I think he's an attacker. I think England need two solid sitting players, and he can play there, but I think he's an attacking option, Mason Mount. So yeah, I think he's one to consider alongside the likes of Grealish and Foden, and certainly Smith Rowe, I think, is similar positionally. Mm. So yeah, yet another attacking option for me.
Right, well, he goes into a bucket of six then in the attacking midfield slash wide options. Grealish, Foden of Manchester City, Sterling as well of City, Saka and Smith Rowe of Arsenal. I mean, that is, you know, putting my fan hat on, that is an exceedingly exciting group of names, six of them there. It means that Jadon Sancho and Marcus Rashford, Michael, were left out of this squad. What did you make of that decision?
Well, I don't think Southgate has ever been particularly enamoured with Jadon Sancho. I mean, he was left out of the 23-man squad for a couple of the games at the Euros. Remember when there was a 26-man squad and three got left out every time? Had a poor start to life at Manchester United. Just come back into form, maybe not quite enough considering some of the other options at Southgate's disposal. I think Rashford's clearly struggling. I don't know why, but he's been out of form for over a year now. Probably needs a break. Probably wasn't going to get a game, so maybe give him some time off. So yeah, England just got so many options in those kind of in-between positions. Like you say, Ali, difficult to know how to categorise some of these players in comparison to one another. But yeah, roaming, versatile, attacking players, England have got a lot of them, which we wouldn't have said 10 years ago.
Well, Southgate's reasoning was on Rashford, it's a difficult time for him. He's clearly not at his best, but we know what he can bring and hopefully he can rediscover the form. With Sancho, it was a little different. He wouldn't have got away with saying he was in poor form because that wouldn't really be fair. He said it's an area where we have big competition for places. And that can be a justification in and of itself, right, Michael, as we're discussing. Realistically, only two of the six names that we've spoken about can start. That's not including Sancho and Rashford. It's a really tough situation for a national team manager to be in.
Yeah, it is. And Southgate is very conscious of the fact that you need to have a good atmosphere in the camp. And I think if you load up on talented attacking players who think that they deserve a game and they don't get a game, things can become a little bit difficult. So I think in those situations, if players aren't going to play, sometimes it's best just to leave them at home, especially when, you know, maybe they could do with, they could benefit from training for their club and getting back into club form. So again, I think Southgate tends to think quite a lot about what individuals need. And it's generally quite fair in these things.
So, Mark, leaving those two behind and just focusing on the six names, probably the biggest question, the thing I find most interesting about the England squad as a whole and Southgate's decision making is which of these players you go with from the start of games and what sort of games make you choose different combinations of players. I think we can assume that Harry Kane will be England's number nine, and we can kind of work off that. There are a lot of questions here as to who you choose, which combination.
Yeah, and as you say, I think it depends on the opponent and the time, whether it's going to be leading up right directly leading up towards a major international tournament or obviously this friendlies like it is. But I think given the nature of Trent Alexander-Arnold and or Reece James not being in the squad because of injury or for whatever reason, I think that it would be good to maybe have the pace and the width of Sterling on the left. And Saka's just been doing so well recently. I know that we mentioned him as an option on the left wing back, but been doing so well for his club that you'd almost want both of those to hug the touchline, stretch the pitch out wide, and be able to sort of have those out to in runs as well, knowing that there's not going to be as much kind of strength from, especially from the right hand side in terms of the right wing back. So for me, with the pace of those two either side of Kane, because Kane seems to have picked up his form again and he's just finding pockets and his vision of some of those passes. The pass for Son the other day was unbelievable. I think it would just work really well. Everyone just seems to be at the time of the season where everyone seems to be have that trait exactly on form. It would be for me Kane with Sterling and Saka either side.
It just makes it so easy for me, Michael, because I won't even need to twist Mark's word. I can just focus on something else that misses the point. That means he's leaving out Jack Grealish, Phil Foden, I suppose to a lesser extent, Emil Smith Rowe and Mason Mount. It's incredibly difficult. Where do you stand on this? Of course, there might be games where England might want more of a threat in behind, and there's certain players suited to that more than others. There might be other games where teams sit so deep that there's very little space in behind, and you want players to come more comfortable moving towards the ball, receiving it to feet. Where do you stand on this?
Yeah, I mean, the more you think about the attacking options, the more you think Southgate probably should be playing a front four in a 4-2-3-1 rather than playing through at the back. I must say, I think Phil Foden is becoming a player that is going to be really difficult to leave out. I think he can play a number of positions. I mean, Kane is undroppable if he's fit, and I think there's a good chance that Foden might play from the left. He is left-footed. He can stretch the play a bit. Has done that for Manchester City. Of course, can come inside as well. I also think there's a really interesting question now about what happens if Kane was to be injured, because Rashford's not in the squad and massively out of form. Calvert-Lewin has had an injury-interrupted season. And again, there were signs that Southgate didn't quite appreciate him at the Euros. Again, he was left out for a couple of the games when I thought of the squad for a couple of games when I thought, well, he's the most obvious plan B. I mean, I do wonder whether if Kane is out and England want a player in his role, I wonder whether that is now Foden. And Foden really does a lot of what Kane does. He doesn't score the goals that Kane does, but in terms of his link play and his passing, I think can play that role. So I think Foden's potentially going to be really, really important for England. I keep on saying this summer, but it's not. This winter.
This winter. I mean, just to pick up on what you said about a potential switch to 4-2-3-1 or 4-3-3, let's say, when you have these names that we're talking about in these areas of the pitch, some of them the best in their position in world football, we're talking about currently a 3-4-3 system where you can only pick two of them. Is there a pretty strong argument, and maybe it's a basic one, that rather than an extra centre-back, probably none of which are considered one of the best in the world in their position, it absolutely makes sense to make the most of your elite talent and put a third player in behind the attacking line? What would that look like for England? What would be potential pitfalls, do you think, in Southgate's eyes? Leave us more open on the counter-attack?
Yeah, I mean, if you play a 4-2-3-1, you need wide players who can defend. And I think that role is different from the roles that, for example, Foden and Sterling play for their club teams. I think Saka can do that well because it's what he does well for Arsenal. And you also need the balance. I mean, you can't load up on four attacking players who are going to run in behind. You need players who want the ball to feet and can operate between the lines. But I think England do have that, particularly Mount. I think that would really benefit him if England had a were playing front four, I think he'd be probably the deepest of the four in terms of what he does on the ball. So there's options there. I mean, there are a lot of attacking options. I think it's possible to argue that there might be too many attacking options. I know it sounds silly, but I think that can happen because sometimes managers end up desperately trying to give everyone a fair chance. And actually, you don't end up spending that much time working on one particular system. But look, the combinations are there. It's down to Southgate to use them at the right times.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
It often feels like in international football, the sort of attacking patterns of play are much harder to establish than at club football, for obvious reasons, to do with training time, realistically. It feels like at England's worst over the last 2 years, and understanding that they have done very well in the two tournaments that Southgate's taken charge of, it feels like those attacking patterns of play, exciting combination play in the final third, Michael, particularly when trying to pick the lock of a deep-lying defence, I feel like that's where England haven't necessarily thrived under Southgate.
Yeah, I agree. And at the Euros, there was a big clamour for Jack Grealish to come on, or sometimes to start games. And I think in certain matches he did that well against Germany, for example. But he hasn't had a great season for Manchester City. And I do wonder whether... I mean, I don't think he's going to fall out of the squad. But Southgate didn't really fancy him when he was on really top form for Aston Villa. So whether he will really go for him after a poor season, I don't know. You could argue the reverse, that actually he's not playing well at City because he's being forced to play as part of the team. And maybe that was Southgate's consideration about him. But I would say that his kind of reputation, his standing in the England squad has probably gone down. And Saka, who, I mean, obviously came into this, the first team midway through the Euros. And he's, I mean, his club form is even better than it was last year. So he's, I think, more likely to start than since he, you know, first came into the squad.
Interesting. I had a list of names that I'd seen people suggesting had been hard done by from not being selected here. New names, as they tend to be. One of them in this area of the pitch was Jarrod Bowen. And with all due respect to Bowen, who I love, and watching his rise from Hereford to Hull to West Ham has been almost as incredible a footballer backstory as the likes of Jamie Vardy. His performances have been so impressive. But as you talk through it, particularly this area of the pitch, you know, it makes it much harder to consider him being harshly done by when you consider the context of the strength and depth that England have in this area of the pitch. At the top of it, Harry Kane is there. Tammy Abraham was selected, which shows that someone's keeping an eye on Serie A, if not necessarily the AC Milan defence. And he's been replaced by Ollie Watkins, who's been added to the squad after the fact. Michael, Kane is 5 off Rooney's record and excitingly looks to be absolutely back to his best.
Yeah, he is in both elements of his game. And yeah, I should apologise to Tammy Abraham, who I didn't mention when I was talking about list of replacements for Kane, but I think if you do want a number nine, then he is probably the, the plan B at the moment. I agree with you about Bowen. I mean, he's having a good season. He's a good player, but there's just too many other options there. I think it's possible to look at, say, 3 years ago when Callum Hudson-Odoi got three caps and say, well, is Bowen playing better than Callum Hudson-Odoi was? Yeah, he probably is, but there's other players who have come into the squad as well. So, Kane, I think, is undroppable. People were calling for him, for others to be giving him a chance when he wasn't in great form, but I think Southgate knows what he's all about. And it's really incredible that he's close to that England goal-scoring record. I mean, in off the top of my head, about 40 fewer caps than Rooney. Obviously, a different type of player, but I mean, he really has been consistent for England. And I think even if he's 70% fit, he starts.
His position is without question at this point, Mark. It makes it quite difficult, I suspect, for other English strikers impressing in the Premier League. I mean, as Michael said, there's a not 0% chance that a Kane replacement wouldn't even be an out-and-out number nine, but would rather be Phil Foden. So it's not an easy position to be in. We've seen Calvert-Lewin, we've seen Bamford. Now we see Ollie Watkins replacing Tammy Abraham. What are Watkins' numbers like this season? Obviously so impressive in his first campaign in the Premier League. Has he been able to continue that form from that impressive first season, or has there been a bit of a drop-off?
Yeah, he's actually really close to last season in terms of his overall numbers. And I think sometimes you can look at it in terms of form as well. Like across the aggregate, across the whole season, it's pretty similar. But obviously everyone goes through peaks and troughs, especially strikers. So maybe despite the feeling that he's maybe not hitting the heights of last season across the, you know, on a per 90 basis, his numbers are actually really similar. So he scored 7 non-penalty goals in the league this season. So that's a rate of about 0.3 per 90. So scoring just shy of 1 in 3. A little lower than last season, which was 0.35 per 90. So on the right side of a 1 in 3. So, you know what I mean? Not too dissimilar. He was scoring exactly the same rate as his non-penalty expected goals last season. So, you know, exactly on... you know, given the chances he found himself in, he was scoring exactly that same rate. And a very minor underperformance this season, you know, but all things considered, to sort of answer your question, has there been a drop-off? Not significantly, but I think, you know, as I say, players go through, you know, patches of form. But I think when you mentioned Bamford, and we spoke about it before with Dominic Calvert-Lewin, I think it was probably only ever going to be Ollie Watkins. Obviously, Tammy Abraham's had to drop out as well. But through other circumstances of Bamford being out with injury, Dominic Calvert-Lewin obviously with injury and not quite hit the heights even since he's come back. Everton obviously not having a good season. It seems like Ollie Watkins was probably the only choice, you know, the realistic one.
Yeah, I do wonder about Ollie Watkins' kind of suitability for England long term. And he's I think of him as a good young player, but he's 26. He's probably not that far off his peak. And I know players in his mould can develop late. I mean, Jamie Vardy, when he was 26, was nowhere near the England reckoning. But I do think England have other options. And like I say, I would include Foden almost as a forward now. I would be surprised if Watkins made the squad for the World Cup. I think there's more chance that Calvert-Lewin comes back into form, Rashford comes back into form, Abraham keeps doing it. So yeah, there aren't that many fit and in-form strikers, so why not? Keep him in the squad. I mean, he has scored for England on his debut, but I'm not sure that he sticks around for Qatar.
Scored his first professional senior league goal in the 2015-16 season, which feels like a long time ago, which definitely adds to that feeling of, is he a young player? Is he not a young player? He's had an amazing career up to this point, played a lot of football for his age, that's for sure. So we talked through the squad there, and I think it's been a useful exercise. Certainly for me, it can be easy to get carried away with, this is a disgrace, he should be in, he shouldn't be in, all of those sorts of things. Michael, I wanted to ask you what you consider, or maybe what you think Gareth Southgate considers to be the point of international friendlies, such as the fixtures England have this week. Is it to experiment, to give a go to new players or new tactics, just to see how things go, and to use non-competitive games to do that, where the results themselves matter less? Or is it to strengthen an established core and get those players more reps, so to speak, so that when a tournament comes around, your core group of players, realistically 16, 17, 18 players that will play the majority of minutes, so that they are telepathic, so that they have played enough football in this England shirt to perform best as a group.
A bit of both, I suppose. I don't think you want to be chopping and changing players, too regularly, because you basically don't want to be doing that in tournaments, and you want familiarity and you want players with a good harmony, good relationship, particularly in defensive positions, I think. And I think broadly speaking, you know, sometimes we hear people talking about England and people use the phrase, oh, the step up to international level. We all know really that the Premier League is probably played at a higher level to most international games, even when you get to the tournament itself. So I don't think you need to worry too much about that. I think it's just about testing players in a certain system, in partnerships, and yeah, just getting kind of familiarity and cohesion. And particularly at the back, I think that's really important.
I think as well, Southgate's really big on having the whole sort of training camp and the duration of the, not just necessarily the games themselves, but, you know, how the players are amongst the group. And he's created such a good environment that I think it's getting them involved for that whole period that they're together. I mean, St. George's Park's obviously such a it's been a good site for a long time, but it just seems to be such a really important site for the players now. And they all love coming back to St. George's Park. So I think as much as the games themselves, it sounds silly, but obviously a lot of time in St. George's Park and on the training pitch, I think, is also useful when, you know, Southgate's picking players like Tariq Mitchell and Mark Guehi.
Spot on. Michael, in terms of experimenting, I know that Southgate has flipped between the flat back four and the three at the back system. My perception of the squad was that the inclusion of Cody and the amount of centre-backs meant that we could expect to see the 3-4-3 to start both of these friendlies. From what you've said, you're not necessarily so sure on that. We might see a 4-2-3-1. We might see an extra attacking player played in one of these games.
I think so. I think it'd be silly not to give it a go. And because that means, yeah, you get to give an opportunity to another attacking player, and that is what England have an abundance of.
And lastly, just on squad announcements and the response to them, we do seem to be a nation very keen for a certain amount of turnover, a certain amount of new shiny players getting their chance. Maybe day-to-day we are less interested in an established group. It's hard to compare to other nations, but that's a sense that I get. It strikes me that we're far enough into Southgate's reign now, and he has had enough success, although not the ultimate success, that realistically it feels like there are very few spots up for grabs, actually. And the fact that he's built a solid group of senior players should be celebrated as a major factor in recent success. And I mean, it's probably too much to ask, but maybe should be considered a little more in those initial hours after squad announcements.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, Southgate has rejuvenated the squad a couple of times already, and he's got a group of players who, one, are very talented, and two, I think, seem pretty settled and pretty cohesive off the pitch as well. There's been absolutely no reports of, you know, dressing room divides, or people used to talk about how there was kind of cliques with different clubs and that kind of thing. There's been none of that. And I think that's really important when you're going to be taking a group of 23 players to Qatar for a month. You don't want anyone falling out. So little things like that are important. And let's remember, I mean, England's results the last two tournaments have been pretty good. I mean, to get to the semi-finals and then to the final, there's no overhaul needed here. There might be a few tweaks and a few different details that need to be different in the final third in particular, maybe in terms of the formation of the side, but I don't think there's any great call for an overhaul of the side. I think this is a really good squad.
A tactical improvement is what you'd like to see in the big games.
Yeah, pretty much. I've no doubt that England will, you know, have always been pretty good at qualifying over the last 10, 15 years, obviously after Euro 2008, and under Southgate have done well in the group stage as well. It's just those big games. And it always, you know, when you look at how many actual contenders you play at international tournaments, sometimes you only have to play a couple, really. I mean, the last tournament is probably Germany and Italy, England had to get past, with all due respect to Ukraine and Denmark. It just comes down to the one or two games where you have to get things right. And I'm not quite sure England have, but they're broadly on the right track.
Let's see how these friendlies go. After them, It's a busy UEFA Nations League campaign in June, 4 games. 2 against Hungary, 1 against Italy, 1 against Germany. Those will be good tests. And then 2 more in September, Italy and Germany once more. And then, of course, the 2022 World Cup in Qatar in November and December, a tournament for which England are currently the 3rd or 4th favourite with the bookmakers. You've got Brazil and France, the two sort of stronger favourites, and then a group including Spain, England and Germany all bunched together. Let's close the book on Southgate and England next week. Let's see where we go. I have a suspicion that Xavi Hernandez and Barcelona might be on the menu after that resounding El Clasico victory. Thank you so much to Mark and to Michael for talking me through all things England. I feel refreshed and well prepared for this international break from an England perspective. 8 months out from the World Cup in Qatar, some interesting talking points. Make sure you're reading everything on the Athletic site. And if you don't have a subscription, you can't do that. If you want a subscription, you can get one for just £1 a month for the first 6 months of your annual subscription by heading to theathletic.com/tactics. That's for the written stuff. For the audio stuff, make sure you subscribe to this podcast and all the others in the Athletic stable. So many good things out there at the moment. We hope that you're across them all. Thanks for listening to this week's Athletic Football Tactics podcast. We'll talk again next time.
The Athletic.